You're listening to SurgeCast, a podcast made specifically for busy general surgery residents.
All right, guys, welcome back to SurgeCast. As a reminder, we're still in the section of alimentary track talking about the esophagus, and topics we're covering today is both hiatal hernias and hiatal hernia repair. So we're going to start you off with the anatomy here. Any discussion of a hiatal hernia is not complete without talking about the different types. So a type 1, or your sliding hernia, basically is where the GE junction slides above the diaphragm out of its normal position in the abdomen. The type 2 is the rolling hernia, and that's really where the stomach just kind of slides up into the thoracic cavity and the GE junction remains in a normal position. Type 3 is basically type 1 and type 2, meaning both the GEJ and kind of that top part of the stomach are moving into the thorax. And then type 4 is any other abdominal organ herniates into the thorax along with the stomach. Gonna really highly recommend you guys just real quick Google a picture of that to take a look at those side by side to really understand that. Epidemiology of hiatal hernias, so the prevalence can range from 10 to 60% depending on the series of patients you're looking at, the age of the patient population. Remembering that this is really rare in individuals younger than about 50 to 60, but increases with prevalence as people get older and older. Sliding hiatal hernias, or type 1, represent about 95% of all hiatal hernias, and lots of people can have these and not even know that they have them. Pathophysiology of these, so many factors have been proposed to contribute to the development. Progressive widening of the esophageal hiatus, largely that's thought to be due to increased intra-abdominal pressure. Progressive esophageal shortening, mostly due to fibrosis or other factors, or age-related laxity in the phrenoesophageal membrane. So these patients are going to show up usually with kind of some combination of dysphagia, odynophagia, or early satiety. Sometimes they can present with mucosal ischemia or mechanical ulceration of the gastric mucosa, or with shortness of breath due to a hernia that's large enough in the chest that it's actually decreasing kind of the space for the lungs to expand. And in very rare cases, but very important to think about, is patients with these can present with stomach volvulus, either in that organoaxial or pyloroaxial rotation, remembering that that's kind of if it's rotating around the axis of the stomach or the axis of the pylorus.
Hey, perfect. So I'm going to go over kind of the diagnosis and some of the laboratory and imaging findings. The first thing you want to ask yourself is, am I dealing with a patient that's asymptomatic, a patient who's symptomatic but not quite incarcerated or strangulated, or number three, a patient who's actually very sick because they are incarcerated or strangulated at this point. So in somebody who is asymptomatic, more than likely the reason that we even know they have a hernia is because it was noted on EGD or some sort of axial imaging or a chest x-ray kind of incidentally. And so maybe somebody saw a big gastric bubble above the diaphragm, or it was noted on CT performed for another reason. If that's the case, then what you're going to see is when you perform your EGD, you'll retroflex, and you may have a hiatal hernia, which is basically you're looking at the crura that are not particularly tight around the esophagus, and that's where you get your Hill grade from. There's four different types of Hill grades. They're probably a little bit too in-depth for the purposes of this lecture, but if you're interested, you can certainly look that up. And then the other thing that might be noted on EGD is differences in the Z-line positioning, which may indicate a type 1 hiatal hernia. Remember that the normal Z-line is at around 30 to 40 centimeters from the incisors on EGD. So moving into that patient now that's symptomatic but not quite strangulated, the first thing you want to do is a barium swallow and maybe also an EGD, and that'll help you kind of work up exactly what you're working with. And the indications for surgical intervention at that point would be somebody who had failed medical management, somebody who's having complications related to GERD, such as strictures or a Barrett's esophagus, somebody who has postprandial chest pain or postprandial abdominal pain, or someone who has recurrent ulceration or bleeding, anemia. And finally, in that sick patient who's incarcerated, strangulated, that patient will present with dysphagia, emesis, and chest pain, and it's really, really important to get early imaging, either with a chest x-ray or urgent CT scan, and it might be worth it also to place an NG tube if you need a little bit more time before you can get them to the operating room, or you just need to temporize them for a minute or two before surgery. But in general, the answer in this patient is going to be emergent surgery. Ideally, you'd be able to get an upper GI barium swallow or manometry or endoscopy beforehand, but again, you don't want any of that to kind of delay the operating room. So getting in now to the management options for folks with hiatal hernias, I'll go over the non-operative management, then Catherine can kind of go over how to do a parasophageal hernia repair. The non-operative management is, again, preferred in a patient who has a symptomatic hernia, but is preferring just conservative management or is not a surgical candidate by your discretion. So these folks are managed similarly to those with GERD, which is, again, lifestyle management, so weight loss, smoking cessation, et cetera, or just with a PPI.
So the operative management for this is the paraesophageal hernia repair, remembering that this is nearly always performed laparoscopically or robotically due to the improved access to the hiatus. So we're going to kind of go over it from that point of view. You really want to ensure that there is an NG tube in place for stomach decompression. That's an outrageously important part of this operation. It's going to make the operation safer and easier for you. Your first step is to insert a liver retractor. Operating in that hiatus, often that floppy part of the liver is just hanging over the top and you got to move it out of the way. Then you need to perform a reduction of the displaced organs and dissection and excision of the hernia sac. You want to remember in cases in which there's incarceration or strangulation of the stomach can be very friable. And for that reason, you want to really be thinking about putting traction on the hernia sac and not the stomach itself. Next step is to take down the short gastric vessels. You'll need to open the gastrohepatic ligament, dissect the hernia sac off the right crura, and then you want to be making sure that you're preserving those posterior and anterior vagal nerves. After you've done your esophageal dissection, you really want to make sure, again, that crucial number of 3 centimeters of distal esophageal mobilization. You'll then need to perform an anti-reflux operation, either a Nissen or a partial fundoplication. Most of that decision is based on the findings of your preoperative manometry, and remembering that we described the steps of that in our prior module. Next step is to repair the hiatus using a tension-free crural closure with or without mesh. There's some debate about this and kind of new information, but traditional teaching really is to use biologic mesh due to the risk of esophageal erosion with non-absorbable mesh. Just remembering that that is kind of evolving over time as we get more and more data. Another option you need to think about for these patients with paraesophageal hernias is when you should perform a PERT gastrostomy. So those patients you really want to think about, patients who had an urgent operation, patients who had a very short esophagus and had to have an esophageal lengthening procedure, or those patients who had a very large hernia and concern for stomach viability. That PERT gastrostomy can really help hold the stomach in place, or can help temporize a patient who maybe is too sick to have the full paraesophageal hernia repair at that time. Postoperative complications, so pneumothorax is obviously a possibility. Thinking about you really are operating right up there at the diaphragm, getting into that kind of pleural space is common, absolutely happens, and you just need to be ready to manage that. Gastric or esophageal perforation is a possibility, especially in patients who had any sort of incarceration and therefore have a more friable stomach or esophagus. And then a little bit of a later complication is that remembering that that wrap can slip.
Yeah, perfect. Just kind of for, I guess, comedic effect, I remember this kind of point about a biologic mesh versus a synthetic mesh. One of my attendings telling me that he would personally testify against me if I ever put a synthetic mesh around the esophagus. So just remember that is not the answer on the ab site. And now I guess we can move into the high points. So the first one is, what are the 4 different types of hiatal hernias?
So type 1 is a sliding hernia, and basically all that is the GE junction has basically slipped up above the diaphragm. Type 2 is called your rolling hernia. That's where the stomach has slid up above the diaphragm, but the GE junction has remained below. Type 3 is basically your GE junction and that little piece of your stomach are up in the thorax. And then type 4 is the presence of any additional abdominal organs above the diaphragm.
Yeah, that's right. And again, they may ask you what's the most common organ other than the stomach to be up there, and the answer to that would be colon. Okay, so Catherine, what are the basic steps performed in a paraesophageal hernia repair?
So if you had to do this in five steps, you'd want to say you would reduce the hernia contents, you would completely excise the hernia sac from the posterior mediastinum, you would mobilize the distal esophagus, making sure you're getting 3 centimeters of intra-abdominal esophageal length, you'd perform your anti-reflux operation of choice, Nissen, toupee, or Ador, depending on the findings of the patient's manometry. And then finally, you would repair the hiatus using a tension-free curl closure with or without a mesh buttress.
Okay. And so what's the kind of option for non-operative management in folks who have a hiatal hernia?
Basically, the thing that's really disturbing these patients is their GERD, and so you treat their GERD. So lifestyle management, PPI.
Okay. And finally, and somebody presents with an acutely incarcerated and possibly strangulated hernia, what are some special considerations that come into play there?
You really want to ensure those patients have early NG tube placement. Kind of not placing that NG tube early can increase their risk of kind of perforation or necrosis. Those patients really need to move urgently to an operation. Be very careful when you're manipulating the stomach due to the possible friability. And then consider a SAM gastrostomy with those patients.
Perfect. I think that's going to bring us to the end of this lecture. We will see you again for the next one on esophageal perforation.
You can find SurgeCast on Spotify or iTunes. Make sure you follow us on Instagram or Twitter @SurgeCastPodcast or find us at SurgeCastPodcast.com.